ladies and gentlemen, if I could get your attention, please. My name is Francis Moriarty. I'm the second vice president of the Foreign Correspondents Club, and it's my honor and privilege to welcome you all here today. A piece of advice that you hear all the time from us: please reach into your pockets and put your telephones either on silent or off. If you need to take an urgent call, please step down the stairs over there and you can do a call there. It's always unsettling in the middle of speech to suddenly have beepers and buzzers going off around the room. A reminder that we're coming up to Chinese New Year. The club will be closed on Saturday. Most of you will have seen the hours on that on your email, and you should check that so you don't show up and find the door locked. It's also the day of the staff party, and believe me, our staff knows how to party. We have some upcoming club events on the 11th of February. Club event FCC Speed Network Expand Your Rolodex. I don't know if people still use Rolodexes anymore, but you can expand it in any case. On the 12th, we'll have a club lunch with Christy Liu from CNN and Christy Liu Stout and Keith Bradshaw from the New York Times on Typhoon Haiyan, Behind the Lens, Beyond the Headlines, covering the story. And on the 23rd, and that's of today, when I do my introduction right now, for our speaker: Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Tao, Ancient Chinese Thought in Modern American Life. I'm going to assume that maybe that can be expanded to life outside America as well, but our speaker can perhaps inform us about that. How would Confucius react to same-sex marriage in the United States? Can Chuangzi contribute to debate on abortion? These are the kind of questions that our speaker looks at and thinks about and is going to talk about with us here today. Our speaker currently teaches Chinese politics and ancient Chinese philosophy at Williams College in the United States, completed his PhD in political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and has taught at Georgetown and Hopkins Nanjing Center in China. His 2002 book, Aiden's Way, drew on Taoism to reflect upon the life of his profoundly disabled son, and I know he'll be speaking about that in a few minutes. Since then, our speaker's read more widely in classical Chinese thought to produce his most recent book on life and liberty, which takes concepts from pre-Qin Confucian and Taoist texts and applies them to contemporary American social and ethical issues. Without further ado, I'd like to introduce philosopher, professor, and good friend, Sam Crane. Sam?
Good afternoon. It's great to be here in Hong Kong and at the FCC. I'm one of those old guys who first came to Hong Kong in 1983. So I'm the one of those ones who wanders around muttering, everything's changed. But it's good. I love being here, actually. I want to do three things today. Actually, before I even start that, I'll say I'll really try to respect local customs, keep it to about 20 minutes so that I can leave time for questions and end at the usual time. Though, of course, for an academic, 20 minutes is just about clearing my throat, but I'll try to be disciplined. Three things today: just provide a little background on where this book comes from, then just give you a sense of what kind of arguments that I'm making here, and actually draw in an example, a current example that's not in the book but is sort of out there in the news today. And then finally, especially if I have some time, finish with some observations about the politics of this book. I'm, after all, a political scientist and tend to think about politics. And I don't talk about this topic in the book itself, but now that the book is out there in the world, I expect there to be a kind of political response to it. Background: Francis mentioned about 10 or 12 years ago, I started thinking about ancient Chinese thought and modern American life, and that had everything to do with the birth of my son, Aiden, who was born profoundly disabled. He was our first child. This posed a very challenging, kind of difficult period for my wife and I, you know, figuring out expectations about how do we understand disability, how do we provide the best life for our son, And in the course of that, I turned to Taoism, which I had had some familiarity with when I was in college. I drifted away from that. Came back and I started reading more of Tao Te Ching and Zhuangzi. And especially in Zhuangzi, there's all sorts of images about disability, about deformity, about marginalization. And he uses those things to sort of reverse the valuation. And I found a lot of solace there, actually. So in a very direct and personal way, ancient Chinese thought really spoke to my modern American life at that time. And I published that book as sort of a reflective memoir using Taoism to think about our family and his experience and the meaning of disability. Beyond that, then, in some ways, being here today is a continuing influence of Aidan in my life, because I then started to read more in Confucianism and Moism and some other of the pre-Qin. I'm pretty much a pre-Qin person. So if anybody wants to, you know, sort of raise questions about Zhuxi or Neo-Confucians, I'll just say right now, I'm not going there. Pre-Qin, I'm good at, though. Started reading more, and I teach a class at Williams on ancient Chinese thought. And I find on a daily basis, as I wake up in the morning, turn on the machine, scan whatever the news is, I find resonances in what's going on around me, and these texts, these ancient texts that I think about and read and teach and write about. So this book is essentially an effort to systematize that, to sit down and think, okay, let me extract some basic principles and apply them in a particular way. So move on just to talk about the book and the arguments that I make there, and then maybe reach for a new example that's not in the book. What I do is, after a little introduction, I do just that. I extract some basic principles. Now, of course, you know, these are big, complex systems of thought. There are many different kinds of concepts in there. I choose to highlight three for both Taoism and Confucianism, just as a starting point. I've been giving talks about the book now since it came out in November, and it's not unusual for somebody to say, hey, you know, what about Xiao, you know, and what about filial piety? You don't foreground that sufficiently. And I have my reasons for that, and I'm happy to engage with that kind of question at question and answer period. But just as a starting point, because I'm understanding this book as written for people coming to these philosophies for the first time, and then I move on to apply those basic principles to specific social and ethical issues, contentious ethical issues across what I'll call the arc of life. So there's a chapter on birth, issues to do with abortion, stem cell research, in vitro fertilization. There's a chapter on childhood, which ultimately crystallizes in the question, should children who commit heinous crimes be tried as adults? This happens in the United States fairly commonly, actually, that children are treated like adults in the legal system. Then a chapter on work, a chapter on marriage and child rearing, a chapter on public and political life, and finally a chapter on end-of-life issues. So most of those are, again, social and ethical issues there. On the Confucian side, the three concepts that I use and apply across those are Ren, Yi, and Li. So something like humanity or benevolence, Ren. Something like duty or appropriateness, Yi. Something like ritual or rites, Li. There's all sorts of interesting translation issues here, which again I'm also happy to talk about in question and answer period. And would leave us with some general orientation along the lines of, we find our best selves through the conscientious cultivation of our closest loving relationships. If you shook me and woke me up at 3 a.m. and said, what is Confucianism? That's probably the words that would come out of my mouth, that we find our best selves through the conscientious cultivation of our closest loving relationships. To put it in language closer to the texts themselves, we should enact duty according to ritual to move towards humanity. Those are pretty general ideas, but I think it's a starting point that allow us to extrapolate into particular kinds of questions that come along. On the Taoist side, I use Tao, De, and Wu Wei. Tao, of course, is the famous first line of the Tao Te Ching, Tao Ke Tao Fei Chang Tao, right? The Tao that can be made manifest or spoken of is not the real Tao, which means you can't really use language to define it, which is really sort of a problem for somebody like me, because here I am trying to use language to define it. In its broadest sense, I think Tao is meant to present us with sort of a cosmic vision, the idea of everything simultaneously unfolding now. And that's a useful idea for Taoists because it instills in us a kind of humility. How can we possibly think that we can shape the unfolding of Tao? Because we can't, we should trust our inherent intuitions and take no action that might be contrary to the natural unfolding of things. So that's the general Taoist orientation that I put out there. Again, rather abstract, but I use that to extrapolate responses to particular ethical challenges. So instead of using an example from the book, I want to use an example of something that's out there right now. And it's a very sad story, a very sad case. Maybe some of you have heard of this. A woman, I believe her name is Marlies Munoz, a woman in Texas who died in November when she was 14 months pregnant. Tragedy for her family. In the hospital setting, her vital signs stopped. You know, they had a ventilator on, etc. The medical staff came to the family and said, you know, someone on the medical staff said, your wife is dead. It's time to turn off the machines. We have to consult with the family about that, etc. The family, the husband, and her parents came to the decision, as difficult as that is, yes, it's over. The hospital administration stepped in and said, no, you can't make that decision because there's a law in the state of Texas that says in order to preserve the life of a fetus before viability, you have to maintain life support systems like this. They took the decision right out of the family's hands, and currently right now, she is still on that life support. The medical reports that have come out describe her as brain dead. So it's not a persistent vegetative state. It's not a coma. And I, you know, these are arguments, you know, biological conditions that doctors and professionals will argue about. But it seems like, you know, it's an extreme condition of literally keeping a dead person alive in order to fulfill this particular state law. I believe there's going to be a hearing on Friday, tomorrow, Texas time, to kind of continue along, because the family has sued the state and said, no, you know, we should be able to make this decision. This is wrong. So this is the kind of story that when I'm presented with it, I start thinking right away, you know, what would Confucius do? And in this case, I think Confucius would resist, or I should say, a modern day Confucian, or someone who's thinking the way I'm thinking. By the way, I don't consider myself a Confucian. I'm just kind of using these ideas in a way that I think is in keeping with the spirit of these texts. So a modern-day Confucian would look at that and say, no, it would resist the state of Texas on a number of grounds. So in the book, I talk about a Confucian orientation towards abortion. And there, I think that a Confucian view, and again, I'm extrapolating, there's no mention in the Analects or Mencius of these kinds of issues. But there's a, behind all the tragedy and sadness of these kinds of cases, there's a kind of marvelous philosophical question, you know, what is the beginning of life? When does life begin? And I think for a Confucian, life begins, or the beginning of life, is not so much a biological act as it is a social act. It's when we enter into those social relationships and we're embedded in kind of a context where we can cultivate that best sense of ourselves and kind of we receive that reciprocally from others, that life really begins. And if that's the case, then I think that in these kinds of situations, it really becomes a matter of the parents and the family involved understanding whether they're able to bring a new life into the world and provide it and cultivate the relationship with that new child in a way that is would not disrupt their already existing obligations to their family members. So there are some hints in the Analects, actually, where a Confucian idea would be that our obligations, our duties to the already born would take precedence over potential but not yet realized duties to the not yet born. And if that's true, and I think it is in the Analects, then in these kinds of cases, and it's, again, as difficult as they are, there would be grounds for parents to make a decision to end a pregnancy that way. I should also say that Confucian ethics generally is more situational than what we see in the case in Texas. The idea of having one law that we lay down and attempt to capture a wide variety of difficult cases would be abhorrent to a Confucian. You need to have a certain space, you need to have a certain freedom to, and a moral agency, to calculate and think about exactly what your obligations are in this particular case towards your extant family members or other loving relationships you have, and the state or other outside forces really can't do that for you. So I think Confucians would resist both on that general kind of situational orientation that they have, but also on the case that the idea that there is a singular biological beginning of life that also extends across all cases, I think would not be in keeping with a Confucian conclusion to that. Taoists would also resist the state of Texas in this case, but on different grounds. And that's part of my purpose here. The abortion debate in the United States tends to crystallize and fall into these very well-worn, hackneyed sort of positions. I'm sure you all could recite the arguments for and against abortion. There's very little variation, so we always bring up the same arguments over and over again. And that's fine in some ways. But one of the values of bringing Confucianism and Taoism into it, I think, is they offer different reasons for some of the same conclusions that we might come to. Abortion questions might still be binary, yes or no, but the reasons offered, in this case a Confucian reason about kind of a social context, it wouldn't rely upon biological assertions of beginnings of life, or wouldn't rely upon a sanctity of life argument based on kind of a religious invocation. That is a different, unique kind of grounding for it. So does Taoism. In this case, I think Taoists generally would be against abortion, because the idea of not intervening in the natural unfolding of things. Taoists might, when presented with other kinds of cases of abortion, might kind of ask questions. Well, why? Why do you think you can't go through with this pregnancy and bring a new child into the world? What is it about your expectations now that you think are going to be disrupted? Maybe the problem is your expectations and how you've reified them in some way. So that's a general Taoist orientation, I think, to the abortion question. But in this case, again, like Confucians, but even more so, Taoists are situational. Some would argue there isn't really a kind of Taoist ethics, that it's too open-ended. But I'm happy to argue that I think there are a Taoist ethics. And in this case, it's not so much a question of abortion, it's a question of end of life. This person has died and has been artificially kept alive. So the intervention in the natural unfolding of things has happened in the instance of the life support that's been going on. So I think a Taoist, when confronted with this particular case, would again ask, well, why are we doing this? There's no particular sanctity to a particular potential human life, a fetus. It would depend on circumstance, and in this case, as the sad circumstances that there are, would not be sufficient to, I think, counteract a Taoist rejection of the state of Texas's stance in this case. So in this particular case, I think Confucians and Taoists would agree, and they would offer arguments that would push against what's going on there. And again, they're arguments that are not the arguments that are going to come up tomorrow in Texas. Now, those will be arguments based on individual rights, which, you know, I respect, you know, clearly. There'll be arguments about the beginnings of life, about the sanctity of life, et cetera, et cetera. But again, what I'm hoping that this book and these kinds of arguments do is show that there's other things to think about beyond that. There's other ways of conceive and contemplate these kinds of issues beyond. I would be very surprised if there was a Taoist or a Confucian in the hearing room tomorrow in Texas. But maybe there should be. So let me go. Am I really going that fast? It's extraordinary. I have left enough time to do a third thing here, and that's to talk about something that's not in the book, but sort of hovers around the book, and that's the politics of doing something like this. My approach here, I think, is to use Taoism and Confucianism, and the political questions come more from the Confucian side of things, because as you're aware, there's a revival of Confucianism in the PRC these days. There's all sorts of political debates that surround that. And I find myself entering into those in a certain way. I'm sharpening my arguments for certain encounters I'm sure to have soon down the way. Because the Y approach in this book is really an old-fashioned kind of practical ethics approach, which looks at, you know, philosophy as a way of life. It's not a rational kind of Anglo-philosophical thing. It's thinking about philosophical systems and how they might inform us in how to live good lives, kind of an old-fashioned virtue ethics, the old ancient Greek ideas there, in fact. So in that sense, my understanding is that, especially in the way I'm using Confucianism here, I'm using Confucianism from the bottom up, opening up this system of ideas to individuals as they move through their lives and encounter difficult circumstances. And this just gives, or it adds to the repertoire of ideas and orientations we have that sort of we're thinking through. You know, my son was just born disabled, or, you know, my father is on, you know, his last legs. How do we grapple with these issues? Of course, in the PRC now, there's another orientation to using Confucianism, and that's from the top down, thinking about it as a source of law, a framework for a constitution, say. There's a Confucian scholar, Jiang Qing, not the same as Mao's wife, it's a different Jiang Qing, who has argued in the past that because, you know, China's going through modernization so rapidly and so destabilizing socially and culturally, that they need to have, there needs to be a more of a cultural kind of unity, something like a religion, something like a state religion. You know, the UK had Anglicism, and they seem to do all right in terms of managing modernization and rising power. So maybe China needs Confucianism as a state religion. He's argued this. He's also argued more recently that Confucianism should provide a foundation or a framework for a state constitution in China. I think when I think about these approaches to Confucianism, I think they really are dangerous for Confucians, because for Confucianism to really follow through and provide, you know, or allow us to find our best selves through the conscientious cultivation of our closest loving relationships, people have to be able to exercise a certain moral agency. They need to have enough space in their lives to take decisions that might contradict state law at times, because the particular circumstances require a certain kind of unique and flexible kind of decision making. I think of Xun, the ancient sage king, who was talked about in Mencius, the book Mencius. And there, some of you might know, Xun was super filial. His father tried to kill him a couple of times, and he remained filial to his father. His father told him he couldn't marry, so this posed a moral dilemma for Xun. If he obeyed his father and didn't marry, he wouldn't be able to have children and a family and carry on the realization of humanity into a future, which is a filial act as well. So it's this filial possibility versus that filial possibility. Xuan married without telling his father. The filial thing to do was to disobey your parents. I tell that to my students. They really enjoy hearing that, I must say. But the purpose of raising that here is that that requires a certain kind of space and a certain moral agency and a certain freedom to be able to make a decision that on the face of it might seem to contradict other kind of moral theorizing. And that's what's required. And if you emphasize that top-down Confucianism, a national religion, a constitutional structure, especially in an authoritarian context that we find in the PRC today, I think that creates obstacles for Confucianism as a way of life. And I find myself rubbing up against my good friend Daniel Bell, for example, who has actually edited and published Zhang Qing's book going back. So I'm expecting debates in the future on this question. But to end, I feel like, in fact, the bottom-up approach to Confucianism is really more in keeping with the spirit of those texts. And it's really, in a sense, how far do I want to go? Say it's a more genuine Confucianism than the top-down variety. But maybe not everyone will agree with that. But let me stop there. I'm happy to take questions on the content of the book, the background of it, or extensions of it into other cases, or the political questions I just mentioned. But let me sit down to take your questions.
Thank you very much, Sam. We can see why your students are very lucky to have you as their professor at Williams. I'm going to exercise the chair's prerogative here to get things rolling. You just touched at the end on the political implications. We have today in China a government that is increasingly using Confucianism in whatever that means to them as some sort of moral basis. Now, the image that you used, the question that you used on the extension of life, you have a government that exercises not really robustly, but sometimes muscularly, the one-child policy. At the same time, trying to create a foundation, a moral raison d'etre on Confucianism. Are these ultimately reconcilable?
No. Oh, right side, excuse me. So the one-child policy was sort of horrendous from a Confucian point of view because precisely it's that sort of application of one law across cases. It obstructs families making choices about how they want to carry on humanity into the future. And I would question the premise of the question in that while there's been a revival of Confucianism and the state is obviously calling upon it, kind of referring to Confucianism in certain ways, the foundation of state legitimacy is much more a kind of, you know, economic performance, the kind of material provision that way. So Confucianism has been marginal to state legitimation at best. We all know the story about the Confucius statue that showed, it was like 2 years ago, a statue appeared at the edge of Tiananmen Square, a statue of Confucius, and everybody was, wow, this really must demonstrate the regime is embracing Confucianism in a more extensive way, and it stood there for about a month, and then it disappeared. They moved it indoors, and when asked, the people responsible for it said, oh, well, we just parked it there for a little while. And I think that's really symbolic of the regime, kind of drawing on some Confucian themes, Hu Jintao with the harmonious society. But not really integrating it centrally into state ideology. And I think currently Xi Jinping has moved away from that and pushed more in sort of the renovation of Marxism as an ideological tool. So I think Confucians face a hard time in the PRC still.
All right, open up to questions from the floor.
Who wants to be the brave one to go first? This gentleman here, please identify yourself and any organization and wait for the microphone. I should tell people that this is being taped and we put these up on YouTube so you can always see them later.
Thanks. I'm David Schlesinger. I run my own consultancy. Can you talk about what it's like thinking about and teaching these issues in the woods of Massachusetts? How do your students, who aren't most of them going to be sinologists, integrate this kind of thinking into their own lives?
Thank you. It's a great question. So there's some ironies in that. I'll have some students from the PRC who will come and read Chinese classics with me in the woods of Massachusetts because they only get little snippets of them at home that way. And we have some great conversations. But I find that I, in just my personal life and my just interests, while I wouldn't claim to be either a Confucian or a Taoist, I find myself having more sympathies and kind of tilting more in the Taoist direction. So I'm usually dismayed at the end of my class where we read the I Ching, Tao Te Ching, Zhuangzi, Lun Yu, Mengzi, and Hanfeizi. I ask them, what was your favorite book? Because my favorite book is Zhuangzi. And most of them say, that most of them shy away from Taoism because it's a little fuzzy, it's a little not very useful. Now, of course, these are hard-charging, smart, bright young people who have succeeded in the existing system and are looking to integrate themselves successfully. So the Taoist critique of all of that, maybe it scares them. And maybe they don't really want to embrace it in a certain way. And they find a lot of practicality in legalism, which really does dismay me, I must say. Because I'm pretty anti-legalist, in just from a philosophical point of view. But they have to make their own choices, I guess, and maybe it's a function of where they are in their lives or something. So many of them open themselves, though, to these texts. We read them front to back. We don't just read little pieces of them, and I make them contend with the entire books. And I plead with them to keep the books and to read them again, because as you go through life at different stages, you're going to learn more from them and see them in different ways.
Speaking of books, I'm going to interject here. There are books on a table out there. You can purchase them on the way out, and I'm sure get them signed if you want. And as somebody who grew up in the woods of Massachusetts, we find practicality in practicality. Do we have any further hands out here, I hope? Please wait for the microphone and identify yourself. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Houghton Lee, a member here. A lot of Chinese scholars say the Confucianism is basically is a philosophy for the Mandarins, for the civil servants who manage the system. But Taoism is restricted for, is a philosophy for the emperor who rule the whole empire. And that's why the latter is a bit more fussy, because the emperor need to be more fussy and improvise in managing things. And he doesn't want his Mandarin to guess what he really thinks. Something just like the Confucianism maybe for the civil servant, and the Taoism is for CY Lam, something like that. Do you agree that, or can you comment something on this?
It's a great comment because, in fact, it's right out of Hanfeizi. So Hanfeizi, the great text of legalism, the opening chapters of it really do invoke Taoism in the sense of, we can't know the unfolding of way. The leader has to be inscrutable and fuzzy, as you say. But I see that as sort of a legalist appropriation of Taoism that's not really in keeping with the spirit of Taoism, because ultimately it's serving the interest of power. And when I read the Tao Te Ching and when I read Zhuangzi, I see a critique of power much more so than I see a justification or defense of power. And this is where the ethics of Taoism comes in. There's some passages in the Tao Te Ching which will talk about rapacious bureaucrats taking taxes and doing things that are unway-like, which in a way is sort of impossible because there's nothing outside of way. But there's it's a sort of a rejection of avarice and concentrations of power there. And Zhuangzi, in some ways, just walks away from all of that and doesn't even want to engage to a certain degree. So I think that, and the difficulty of Taoism is it rejects the idea that there can be sort of systematic distinctions and categories or very clear yes and no answers to any particular kind of problem. So that if you were to ask a Taoist, you know, can Han Feizi do this? The answer is, yeah, I guess, you know, if he wants to. I mean, so there's a kind of weakness in Taoism because it can be used. There's nothing internal to the philosophy itself that would keep it from being applied in all sorts of different ways. But I think generally the spirit of the philosophy runs in the opposite direction towards a critique of power.
Anyone else? I'll throw one out there then while people contemplate what you're saying. China is not just influenced philosophically by Taoism and Confucianism. If we look in great spiritual realms, just strictly staying within a wide Asian context, it's very influenced by Buddhism, which you don't mention. But let me just throw that spanner out there and ask you where you see Buddhism fitting in.
Wow. No, so I don't really have that much background to be able to respond to that. But I think the one thing that can be said is that when we talk about Chinese culture, sometimes there's ways that, in some discourses, that gets reduced to Confucianism, that Confucius becomes the sort of symbol for Chinese culture. And there's always more to Chinese culture than Confucianism or Taoism or legalism. It's big and capacious and has these other aspects that are constantly present and interacting with others.
And do you see the fact that these institutes being set up by China called Confucius Institutes are an extension of that?
Well, in a way, it's the regime reaching for what seems to be kind of a friendly face to brand an English language program that the state runs. The Confucius Institutes have very little to do with Confucius. I gave a talk the other day about soft power, Chinese soft power, and my thinking is that Confucianism is not going to serve the soft power interests of the PRC, and I have a variety of arguments for that. And at the end of my presentation, somebody said, "Why didn't you mention the Confucius Institutes?" And my answer is that the Confucius Institutes don't really have anything to do with Confucius. They're just this sort of, kind of happy face floating around out there that doesn't require any kind of serious engagement with the texts of Confucianism.
Questions from the floor again, please. Return you to the floor.
Oh, there's
one
in the back.
Okay, I couldn't hardly make you out back there.
I'm a Swiss journalist, been answering the upshot. The U.S. becomes, through immigration, a much more Asian country. Mm. As you described, probably your course is more kind of a sideshow and interesting to understand Asia. But do you think as through immigration, Asia becomes a more Asian country, these theories already now start to play a role in political life that even would influence foreign policy of the U.S. as we see like kind of Christianity very much, especially under the last president, has influenced American policy abroad. So are you moving from side street to a main movement in the U.S.?
No. So this is something that dismays me. So I'm going to be over at Hong Kong University tomorrow talking to the philosophy department on the topic of why Confucianism is not catching on in the United States. So despite my best efforts, I don't really see Confucianism really catching fire. And I don't think it's really a matter of immigration. It's true that America is becoming more Asian in that way. But there are big, powerful, modernizing forces that I think are really difficult and get in the way of the enactment of something like Confucianism by enough people in enough contexts to really have a societal effect. And in terms of foreign policy, I think states enact foreign policies based on interests and power, and much more than they're ever constrained by philosophical and ethical systems. And unfortunately, U.S. foreign policy is an example of that, you know, going to war and using force in a whole variety of ways that violate not only Confucian principles, but Christian principles as well. So it would be nice if philosophy had a much larger effect on such things, but I'm afraid my sense is that it doesn't.
This gentleman right down here, please. Identify yourself, please.
Hi, my name is Ted Lippman. Just to follow on your point just now, I mean, to what extent does Confucianism actually just represent very similar principles that are accepted in many other societies, but has done so sort of packaged in the Chinese context, which may explain why what you've just said, that there are some things in common, but maybe it's just not catching on for cultural reasons.
Yes, so at a certain level of abstraction, there is a basic similarity between Confucianism and other ethical systems, especially along thinking of, you know, ethical reciprocity. My students are always surprised when we come upon the lines, don't do to others what you wouldn't want done to yourself, sort of the golden rule expressed in negative terms, you know, instead of do unto others as you would want done unto yourself. But even though there are people who will argue there's a difference there, I don't think there is. It's a basic principle of ethical reciprocity, with, you know, putting yourself in the shoes of others, which is very similar across a variety of different philosophical and ethical systems around. So in some ways, yes, there are points of similarity. But then, you know, the elaboration of that in certain ways and the alignment of certain ideas and the cultural expressions of that are what's unique about Confucianism. One of the criticisms of something like what I'm doing, you know, when I take these ideas and apply them into a modern context and I'll stretch their applicability in certain ways, you know, there must be some point at which that kind of stretching gets you beyond a reasonable definition of Confucianism. I don't think I'm there yet, but I think some more conservative interpretations of what Confucianism is might reject some of the arguments I make. For example, you know, I don't think that we can hold on in a modern context to the historical association between Confucianism and patriarchal power, you know, the favoring of men in society over women. That's just not going to fly in modern contexts anymore. And, you know, and there are good arguments out there, different, you know, philosophers who have made this argument that, in fact, there's some interesting similarities between Confucian ethics and feminist care ethics, so that we can have a gender-neutral Confucianism. But I know there's going to be critics for that out there as well. So this becomes a point of debate about at what point does the lapse into similarity erase all difference.
One more hand out here, this lady.
Hi, my name is Mei Zhang. Actually, I also know Daniel Bell because his wife was my colleague at Goldman Sachs. I recently left the firm. But my question is, you said Confucianism is not catching up or getting a lot of attraction in the US. How about in China, especially among the elite group? Because over the years, over the past decade, I think, based on my observation, you know, the master Nan Huaijin has huge followings among the really elite people, including both political elite and business elite. And people are saying he was such a wise man because he spent the last couple of decades of his life based in Suzhou, so it's close to Beijing, but yet not too close. Mm-hmm. And he had been planting seeds in China, and hopefully someday, because China, after all, is really led, the history was led by the elite. Doesn't matter what common people think or know about philosophy.
No, I think it's a fascinating time because there's lots of different things going on, lots of arguments, lots of different interpretations of what Confucianism can be in the PRC now. One of the things that concerns me, though, is the, say, lack of autonomy of the sort of academic sphere. I mean, mean, there's certain limits beyond which you can't really go until you might run into some career problems. And I think that has an effect on the full and kind of development of these ideas, especially at the elite level. So even Zhang Qing, the book that Daniel edited and brought out, the conference that that was based upon had to be held outside of China because there was worries about, you know, him getting into trouble that way. And I think that gets in the way of these sorts of ideas and limits the social, cultural, political impact of what Confucianism can be. You know, in the Chinese context, rapid modernization and the kind of hyper-materialism and conspicuous consumption and just the competitiveness of contemporary Chinese society make it really difficult to consistently follow through with principles of Ren and Yi and Li, because, you know, you have to get that deal done or you have to get the kid into school. And those sorts of, the pursuit of profit, I think does create an obstacle to a wider influence of, or a more genuine enactment of Confucian ideals. So yes, there's a lot of interest, a lot of interesting debate. I think there's both political and sort of socioeconomic obstacles to a full, genuine expression of it.
On that note, we are right at the magic hour here. We don't like our guests to go away empty-handed, so we have back here a small token of our appreciation. And thank you very much, Sam.
Thank you.
Let's show our appreciation.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate being here. Thank you.
And if any of you have any questions or would like to get copies of the book, please do. Thank you all for coming.